Om, 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 om. There we go. I think this one has to be on, right? Thank you. Om Sahanavavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Yogena Chittasya Padena Vacham. Yogena Chittasya Malam Sharirasya Chavhaidyakena. Malam Sharirasya. Yopakarotam pravaram muninam, yopakarot patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Omata yoganushasanam. Very good, welcome back. We'll continue our study of the first pada. We're actually starting to come towards the final section. And just to, before we continue, we've just seen, we're actually at the end of a very important section, giving us various forms of meditation. Specifically, various vishayas, various objects, which are the focal point of meditation, we've seen is going on for about the last six sutras. All of this is leading up to today's class. In fact, really two classes have led up to the subject matter we're going to take today. Today happens to be one of the more, or this next series of sutras is one of the more important. Can't say more important, but we can say that there are quite a few sutras leading up to this point. So there's something going on here. Also, my voice is a little funny today, so we'll see how we do. If I give out, then we may wrap up the class a little early. We'll see how it goes. The best way to start this evening's class is to pick up the next sutra. The 39th sutra will summarize the long passage of sutras, the last six sutras that we've just seen. They'll be summarized by the 39th sutra, and then it'll set us up for the next two sutras. Hopefully we'll see tonight. So the 39th sutra. Yathabhimata dhyanadva. Yatha abhimata dhyanat va. We've seen that va looks familiar, or. We've been seeing that va in many of the prior sutras. And the prior sutras said you can meditate on this, or you can meditate on that, or you can meditate on that, or you can meditate on that. And at one point I commented that sometimes or means and, which means you should meditate on this, and you should meditate on that, and you should meditate on that, and that, etc., etc. Now we come to this sutra, which really ties together a lot of what we've just seen. It says, va, or, alternatively, abhimata dhyanat, yata, in the same manner, or in which manner, abhimata dhyana. Dhyana, meditation, dhyanat, through meditation on abhimata. Now, mata is whatever is a thought. Abhimata is usually translated here as whatever your thought happens to be. Or loosely, you can meditate on whatever you want. That's not a bad translation. Or you can meditate on whatever you want. Yatha, in whatever manner, abhimata, that's desirable, dhyana, through meditation on whatever you want. Now, from there are two ways of understanding this abhimata. So in a general sense, taking it, you can meditate on whatever you want, showing that principle of adhikari bheda we've talked about in previous classes, that principle that everyone is different, everyone will have different inclinations and disinclinations, and here we have a tradition which doesn't try to put us all in a single mold and make us march lockstep, but rather a tradition that acknowledges individual differences and encourages us to incorporate sadhanas, spiritual practices, into our lives, but specific practices which we find particularly helpful for us as individuals. This we've talked about before. Another principle about meditating on abhimata, on what you like. If I tell you to meditate on what you don't like, how much will you perform that meditation? It's interesting. If you want to lose weight, eat foods that you don't enjoy. It works. It absolutely works. When you eat foods that you enjoy, you eat a little more. If you eat foods that you don't particularly enjoy, you eat less. This is human nature. We do less of whatever we don't enjoy. So if the object of meditation is something that's not appealing to you, how much will that work? So in this sutra is some very practical advice. It recognizes that we all pursue that which we find appealing. So one interpretation of the sutra then is to choose an appealing vishaya, object, for meditation. Of course, well, in the next sutra you're going to see that you don't just get to choose one, not at all, but we'll see that in just a moment. So here the principle is, if you're going to choose what to meditate upon, choose something that's appealing to you. And through abhimata dhyana, through meditation on what appeals to you, remember the whole context here. Through that form of meditation, your mind becomes prepared. This whole sequence of the last 7 or 8 sutras has to do with preparing our minds for sampragnata samadhi. Preparing our minds for absorption. So one way then of preparing your mind for absorption is to find anything that appeals to you and use that for the sake of meditation. Anything, of course, within reason. Now there's another interpretation of the sutra. Actually, it's not a different interpretation, but a slight twist on interpretation. Abhimata dhyana, meditate on what is appealing to you. The Jnana Bhikshu has written this Vartika, this sub-commentary on the sutras, on Vyasa's commentary, actually. And he takes it in a very different way. Kim bahuna, says, how many ways you can meditate? Yadeva abhimatam, in the way that you choose. And he starts to give examples. Hari hara murti adikam tad eva adau dhyayet tasmat api dhyanat tatra. He makes some really nice points here. Let me just not drag you through all the Sanskrit. Hari hara murti dhyana. He says you can meditate on some form of God, like Hari, Lord Vishnu, Hara, Lord Shiva, or Adao, etc., any form of Lord you can meditate upon. Most of you are familiar with the Hindu concept of Ishta Devata, a very central principle in these teachings, and that is you are free to choose any form of Bhagavan for the sake of your personal prayer, worship, and meditation. You get to choose. And how different this is from other religious traditions, which say, this is the form in which you have to pray God, and in no other form are you permitted. This is God, this only is God. The ancient sages took a very different approach. In other classes, I've commented that in the Bhagavad Purana and other Puranas, there is a reference to 33 crore forms, 330 million forms in which we can worship God. 330 million, interesting number, was more than the population of this planet in ancient times. Correct? Population of this planet now is 6 billion, but the population of this planet 5,000 years ago was probably less than 330 million. So interesting. Or maybe 330 million was the approximate population of South Asia, perhaps. Which means every person gets to choose his or her own form of God, a form specifically for you. This is a principle of Ishta Devata. That is that you get to choose a devata, a form of God, which is Ishta, chosen by you, desired by you. So the sutra very easily could be interpreted to be a reference to that principle of Ishta Devata. So yatha abhimata, in the way that you choose, you can choose any form of Bhagavan for the sake of your meditation. Now, this all makes sense. Let us not make the mistake, however, of Ishta Devata. There's a significant difference between the principle of Ishta Devata and what's being taught here. In your worship and prayer, you're encouraged to choose an Ishta Devata, a form that appeals to you. You're not encouraged to go on changing that Ishta Devata every 2 weeks. Because to shift that chosen form of God frequently would really detract from its power. Part of the power of worship comes in the depth of devotion to a particular form of God. So generally, traditional teachers encourage that you choose a form and stay with that particular form. Of course, after 10 or 20 years, if you find that you've changed a lot, and I find this in my own prayer life, after 10 or 20 years, we change a lot, and sometimes the form that was most meaningful 10 or 20 years ago is not so meaningful today. So over a long period of time, perhaps it's helpful or appropriate occasionally to change one's Ishta Devata. There's no rule against it. But the principle is not that you would change it frequently. The principle is that you choose a form and stay with that form of God as long as practical. But that's for the sake of worship and prayer. And that's obviously not our subject matter here, which is dhyana meditation. So here, if there is an Ishta Devata chosen for your meditation, don't think that that's the only object upon which you meditate. That's the difference. So in prayer and worship, your Ishta Devata could be the one and only. But in meditation, your Ishta Devata is one of a whole sequence of vishayas, of objects upon which you meditate. In the next two sutras, we're going to explore this idea of a sequence of objects, culminating in sampragnata samadhi. We'll see this in the next two sutras. All right. So next. Paramanu paramahatvantaha asya vashikaraha. Parama anu, parama mahatva antaha. Anu is an atom. Paramanu is like the fundamental particle. It's interesting. Scientists are still searching today for some underlying particle that might be the basis for all other particles. This concept of a basic building block for the universe was already present in the minds of the ancient rishis so many millennia ago. They called it Paramanu, the fundamental particle, the smallest particle. The word atom, I've commented before, is a Greek word, atomos, not breakable. That which cannot be divided is what the Greek word atom means. And the word Paramanu, anu, Paramanu, means exactly the same thing. The smallest and indivisible particle in the universe is called Paramanu. So this is one end of a spectrum, is Paramanu, the smallest and indivisible. What's on the other end? So you start, just a quick aside, did any of you ever see this short science film called Powers of Ten? Familiar to a few of you? It's fascinating. It shows a picture. I don't know. It'll take me too long to explain it. If you're interested, go find it and see it. It's very interesting. It'll give you a different perspective on the universe. Suppose we go from that tiniest little particle and back up. And then we see a whole atom, back up more. You see a molecule, back up more. You see bunches of molecules in a structure, back up more. You see a protein, back up more. You see a cell membrane, back up more. You see a cell, back up more and more and more. You see a tree, back up some more. You see a forest, back up some more. You see a continent. Back up some more, you see a planet. Back up some more, you see a solar system. Back up some more, you see a galaxy. Back up some more, you see a cluster of galaxies. Back up some more. That's, by the way, that's what that Power of Ten movie does. You should see it. It's fascinating. You go from one extreme to the other extreme. To the extreme small, Paramanu, to the extreme big view, which would encompass not just this cosmos, but any possible cosmos, all of the cosmoses, if there are multiple cosmoses, and that's called here mahatva, vastness, mahat, big, mahatva, bigness, vastness. So from Paramanu, from the smallest and indivisible particle, to mahatva antaha, up to, ending with vastness. Asya, for your meditation, for the mind, for the sake of purification, your meditation should be on all of these. And in this way, you would gain vashikaraha. Vashikara means control. Vashikara, control. Control of what? Asya, of this. Of this what? Of this mind. The whole sequence of sutras the sequence of the last 8 or 9 sutras concludes with this one. This one shows the entire range of vishayas, of objects upon which you meditate. And what this says is that the way to gain vashikara, complete control, asya, of your mind, is to perform meditation not just on any one thing, but on a sequence of objects through the entire range. Now let's look at this briefly. From the range of rain, starting with Paramanu, element, meditate on earth, on water, on fire, on air, on space. These were traditional meditations done, not done much in modern times, but in ancient times, this is where your meditation began. You begin by meditating on the element of earth, stuff, matter. And then you proceed to the next more subtle water, and then fire, then etc., one by one by one, starting with the most gross and starting with the smallest, and then getting more subtle and more vast. And we're going to see this even more in the next sutra. Until finally, you've gone through every level in the universe, arising at mahatva, vastness. What do we mean by vastness? I gave the example just a moment ago of the entire cosmos. Or your Ishta Devata would be that same vastness. So to meditate on a variety of objects, either from the smallest object to the biggest object, or from gross objects and culminating with your Ishta Devata, your chosen form of gods, to meditate on that whole range is all done for the sake of Vashikara, for the sake of control of your mind, mastery of your mind. We're still talking about preparation. We shift with the next sutra. Next sutra, we talk about Sampragnata Samadhi with a different word. But this verse concludes this whole sequence. This sutra concludes a sequence of sutras all talking about preparation of the mind, and what a rigorous preparation it is. I bet some of you in your professional training underwent some really rigorous training. I know physicians undergo such training. I'll give you an example. I was trained as an engineer. I remember the kind of mathematics we were made to study. I remember vividly what's called transform mathematics. The use of Laplace transforms and Fourier transforms, very complicated mathematical structures. I'll make a very interesting point, but bear with me for just 2 minutes. But just to give you an idea of how abstract this math got, the problems we were trying to solve were so complicated you couldn't solve them. So the only way you could solve them is by translating the problem into an imaginary mathematical universe, a transform domain. Then you solve the problem in this imaginary mathematical universe, transform domain, and then you translate the answer back into the real world. This kind of math uses lots of calculus, and it is so abstract. Now, think about this. We're a bunch of young engineering students. When will we make use of this kind of complicated math in any kind of profession? Never. Absolutely never. We're not going to become PhDs and all of this. We're engineering students. So what is the point of all of this complicated math for engineering students? Well, as a young engineering student, the answer was there's no application whatsoever. But many, many years later, I realized why they dragged us through all of that complicated and irrelevant mathematics. And really, it was absolutely irrelevant to our work. The reason we were made to learn all that complicated math was to train the instrument. What in the world does all of that complicated calculus and transform mathematics got to do with engineering? Most engineering, nothing at all. But its purpose was in training the mind. And it was difficult. It was incredibly difficult. And many other professions have similar kinds of training where you're made to undergo a tremendous discipline. But the goal is not simply to master that discipline, but rather to take that discipline with you into your chosen field. It's a little bit like the stories that are told of Chinese martial arts, which were actually taught not to make you a master of martial arts, but to teach you a kind of discipline which would then be transferred into some other pursuit to teach discipline. So all of that mathematics was for the sake of a disciplined mind. All of that martial arts in certain traditions is not for the sake of killing people or beating people up. It's for the sake of discipline. And here we're coming to the end of a sequence of sutras that talks about creating a tremendous discipline of mind through a whole sequence of meditations, from gross to subtle, from small to vast. Now, this kind of preparation is really extraordinary. Well, the kind of study we did as young engineering students was pretty extraordinary. This is a kind of mathematics that Nobel Award winners work with, that kind of mathematics every day. We were made to learn that kind of mathematics, which means it's math at a very elevated level, martial arts at a very elevated level, and here, meditation to discipline the mind to a very elevated level. Sampragnata Samadhi, which we're going to discuss starting with the next sutra, is not an ordinary achievement. It requires an extraordinary preparation, an extraordinary discipline of mind. It's not hard to see how indisciplined our minds are. For example, in the half an hour of our class so far, how many times has your mind wandered? Of course it's wandered. It happens. When I was a student, my mind wandered as much or more than yours. Of course it did. And when you try to meditate, how much does your mind wander? In fact, whatever you're doing, whatever we're doing, our minds wander. There's an interesting argument that says that our minds wander more in modern times because of the incredible stimulation we all receive. For example, from media, from TV, everything is always changing. On your television set, everything, scenes change, dialogue change, shows change, everything changing fast and faster and faster. Driving a car, we forget, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, everything went so slow, right? How fast could you travel 200 years ago? What was the fastest mode of locomotion 200 years ago? I hope that's before the steam engine. I think it is. So 200 years ago, before the steam engine, the fastest you could go is you get on the fastest horse and hold on for your life. That's as fast as you can go. That's probably 30 miles an hour. My gosh. And today, we have spaceships going tens of thousands of miles an hour. In ancient times, how fast did things change? In fact, they changed as fast as your crops growing in your fields. You go out from day to day, and farmers do this. They go out every day to check the crops. How much does a crop change in one day? Not much, but they can detect that much change in one day. In ancient times, life moved as slowly as the crops growing in the fields. Today, our lives could not be more different than it was in ancient times. Things change so rapidly in our environments, in our lives, and in our minds. And an argument is made that our minds are much less stable, inherently less stable than they were in ancient times because of this tremendous stimulation and change, rapid pace that we're all subjected to in our environments every single day of our lives. Given that fact, how many modern people go through this kind of discipline to train the mind to that extent? To me, looking at the kind of meditation that's taught in Yoga Sutra, it looks like a lost art. Strikes me very much like a lost art. An art form, it's not an art, of course, but that by like a metaphor, some discipline or art that was practiced in ancient times and is virtually unknown today. This kind of meditation is almost unknown today. How few people really have a commitment to cultivate this kind of meditative discipline. There are still, in the Himalayas and elsewhere, there are still caves in which there are sadhus sitting and meditating. You can find them. How many of them are achieving this, there's no way of judging. But how few people spend a lifetime cultivating meditative skills. Now, this is not meant to be grim, but rather the message is start and go as vigorously as you can. You know, certainly you've already been doing meditation in your life. This discussion, though, shows us the importance of the modern term is ratcheting up the level of effort and commitment. We, as modern people, perhaps start with a disadvantage in that our minds are so habituated to this rapid change. So the challenge for us, perhaps, is even greater. So here, we've now concluded this very very intense sequence of verses, giving us the basic training. I guess it's a term used in military, right? You go to basic training where for a short period of time they make these young recruits go through this really rigorous discipline. Well, this is basic training for the mind. And it's a whole sequence of meditations meant to give you a mind disciplined enough, prepared enough for the sake of sampragnata samadhi. The term used here, vashikara. Total control. Absolute control, vashikara. All right. This leads us now to the next sutra. The 41st sutra looks like a turning point in this whole first pada. So now we're going to talk about sampragnata samadhi, varieties of sampragnata samadhi, and objects for sampragnata samadhi. Everything prior to this is The sequence of sutras prior to this is preparation. But now we're talking about, look at the last word, samapattihi. The word samapatti means, in this context, accomplishment, the conclusion. Samapatti is that which you're seeking, that for which all of this preparation is meant, the achievement, the goal. Here is called samapatti. So here we turn our attention away from preparation, and now we look at the goal. Let's begin. Kshinavrittehe abhijatasya hiva manehe grahitra grahana grahyeshu tatstha taranjanatha samapattihi. This is going to take us a while to get through this one. There is so much teaching in this one sutra. It's amazing. The whole style of sutra is very short, terse statements with so much meaning layered into it. One of the factors that makes this sutra particularly rich with meaning is that it introduces a famous drishtanta, a famous metaphor. The metaphor of the spatika, of the crystal. Get our prop here. You've seen this orange crystal before. And you know very well it's not orange, but you certainly know that the nature of a crystal is to whatever is to take on the color of whatever is nearby. So here, the clearness of the crystal represents the clarity of your mind when it's prepared. Remember, we saw many sutras ago that the preparation culminated in citta prasada, was a term we used, maybe about 7 or 8 sutras ago. Citta prasada, clarity of mind. And here it says, kshina vrittehe, when your vrittis, when your mind activities, mental activities, when your thoughts are kshina, decayed away, withered away, destroyed. Kshina vrittehe, when your thoughts have all been, when your thoughts have all been removed. So that harkens back to that expression, citta prasada, that we saw long ago, that clarity of mind. When the mind is like that pond with no ripples, we gave that metaphor. When your mind is clear, only that clear mind represents, a clear, quiet mind represents a prepared mind. And the reason for that is this: the clarity, the clearness of this crystal, which represents our mind. If this crystal were a milky brown color inside, could you see the orange? No. Could you see the red? No. So the color, the ability of this crystal to take on the color of something outside depends upon its clarity. In the same way, the ability of your mind to achieve some prajnata samadhi, and how that's done will be talked about in this verse, but the ability depends on the clarity of your mind, just as the clarity of this crystal allows the reflection of color, in the same way the clarity of your mind is needed for some prajnata samadhi. And how that takes place is described in a wonderful way here. So kshina vrittehe, for your mind, when your mind is free from vrittis, when all of your vrittis have been, kshinoti means to wear away, have been destroyed, have gone away. Abhijatasya eva manehe. Eva means just like, as. It introduces a drishtanta, a metaphor. Eva, just like manehe, for a money. Money is gem and represents this. So this is our money, our gem. So manehe, for a gem, for a crystal. For a crystal that's abhijatasya, a crystal that's clear. Abhijata doesn't mean clear, but in this context it's referring to a clear crystal. So abhijatasya manehe, for a clear crystal. Eva, just like for a clear crystal, kshina vrittehe, when there's the absence of impurities in the crystal, then skip that one long compound and look down below, then tatstha taranjanata. Then there can take place tatstha and taranjanata, two very important words here. Tatstha, literally in that place, and tad anjanata, being colored by that. Let's explain these two words by the metaphor. Tatstha, the cloth is here, but you see the orangeness in the crystal. The cloth is here, but the orangeness is seen in the crystal. That's tatstha. There, in that place, in the crystal, is the orangeness. Not only is there tatstha, not only is there the cloth orangeness in the crystal, but there's also anjanata. Literally, it means being colored. Anjana, means being tainted or stained. Anjanata, this nature of being tainted or stained. So both of these words, tatsta, being placed in a crystal, tadanjanata, the crystal being colored by that, being placed in a crystal, and the crystal being colored by whatever is placed. This is the metaphor used for, well, the word we've used before is sampragnata samadhi, but that's not the word used here. The word used here is samapattihi. Now, samapatti, as I said a moment ago, means accomplishment. Accomplishment of what? Obviously, what we're trying to accomplish is sampragnata samadhi. Some of you are thinking, wait a minute, wasn't the goal asampragnata samadhi? Yeah. Then why doesn't he say, why isn't the goal asampragnata samadhi? Why is the goal sampragnata samadhi? Can you remember we had this discussion? We said, you can practice sampragnata samadhi. You cannot practice asampragnata samadhi. Or to use more familiar terms, you can practice savikalpa samadhi, you cannot practice nirvikalpa samadhi. And the reason we've given before is that nirvikalpa samadhi, or what better is called asampragnata samadhi, is nothing you can practice, it's a state of achievement, it's a level of accomplishment, it's a point of arrival. You can't practice it, it's a point of arrival. Okay, we've discussed that before. So here, the samapattihi, the accomplishment or experience that we seek, is sampragnata samadhi. Remember our definition of that? We said sampragnata samadhi is a condition, not a condition of absence of thoughts, but a condition in which every mental activity, let me use different words, a condition in which your mental activity is one. One mental activity. Now, of course, the mind goes on changing, so how can you have one mental activity? And the answer is, it keeps repeating itself. Like, om, 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 om. Every om is identical. So when your thoughts become like that, om, 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 every thought is identical to the one that came before, then it appears to be unchanging. It's actually changing. Like, if you look at a river that's, I guess, a fairly deep river, so that the surface of the river is absolutely flat. You look at that river, and that river looks stationary, right? Think of that, that very deep, still river. You look at the river, and based on the surface, based on what you see in the river, it looks like nothing's changing, nothing's happening. But in fact, it's moving. Why do you see nothing changing? It's because the water that's in front of you now is the same as looks exactly the same as the water that was in front of you before, which looks exactly the same as the water that was in front of you before that. It's, the water looks the same. It's different, but it always looks the same. The more traditional metaphor that's given is that when you pour oil from one vessel into another vessel, and when you do it very carefully, you don't move either vessel, and you can get this ribbon of oil that looks like it's suspended in air. Of course, oil is constantly flowing, but it looks like it's a ribbon of oil suspended in air. So these are the metaphors given then for sampragnata samadhi. Just to remind you, before we get into some of the details here given in this sutra. Now, the sutra is telling us a lot. First thing it's saying, in kshina vrittehe and mani, it's referring to the fact that in order for your mind to achieve sampragnata samadhi, it has to be free from vrittis. It has to be as clear as this crystal. Step one. Then, The other part, of course, is that there's tatsta and tadanjanata. There's something being placed in the crystal, something is coloring the crystal. And so, for the sake of sampragnata samadhi, there is an object of meditation. Vishaya is the word we use for object. There's a dhyana vishaya, an object of meditation, which ends up being tatstha and tadanjana. It ends up being placed in your mind and coloring your mind. Just as this cloth is placed in a crystal and colors a crystal, in the same way, the object of meditation is placed in your mind and completely colors your mind. This is a metaphor. Now, how does that work? How are we to do that? And this is big. There's so much going on here. Let's just continue. Let's continue. The way to gain sampragnata samadhi. Two steps. First, prepare your mind. Make your mind as clear as a crystal and make your mind completely controlled, vashikara. How do you do that? Through a lot of prior meditation, a lot of prior discipline. Then, what do? You introduce an object of meditation. Just as I'm introducing the cloth near the crystal, so that the cloth can be placed in the crystal, tatstha, and so the cloth can color the crystal, tadanjana. In the same way, you're going to take a dhyana vishaya, an object of meditation, and hold it close, so to speak, so that it can be placed in your mind, so that it can color your mind. Before we see, it's a complicated discussion, so before we go into that, can you get the point here that the orangeness of the cloth colors every corner of the crystal? This is a metaphor. Is there any part of the crystal in which the orangeness is absent? No. This orangeness is not placed in a single part of the crystal. This orangeness is placed throughout the crystal and colors the crystal entirely. Now, please don't get us... We don't want to get into a scientific discussion about refraction of light and all of that stuff, because that's not our point here. The metaphor is that the crystal is totally transformed. The appearance of the crystal, I should say, is totally transformed, not partially transformed, by the presence of the orangeness. In the same way, your mind is totally transformed by the presence of the object. This crystal is totally orange because of the presence of the cloth. Imagine your mind meditating on, for example, Surya, sun. Suppose, as an example, you're meditating on the sun. How? Om Tat Savitur Varehe Nyam Bhargo Deva. Gayatri Mantra. So using Gayatri Mantra, you meditate on the sun. Now, you are placing the sun in the proximity of your mind. But sampragnata samadhi depends. First of all, your mind has to be clear of everything else, clear like the crystal. Your mind has to be disciplined through prior meditation, vashikara, from prior sutra. And then one more thing, tatstha and tadanjana. That ta affix means ness for both of them. Tatstha ta and tadanjana ta. We can break them into two parts. That is placedness and coloringness, making up English words to match this. What it means for meditation on the sun is this. Just as orangeness pervades the crystal completely, In the same way, meditation on the sun would mean that sunness pervades your mind completely. And the language used by Vyasa in his commentary is, let me just find that passage. I just want to get his expression. Stula lambana uparaktam, stula rupa samapannam, stula rupa abhasam. He uses the terms rupa samapannam and rupa abhasam. In fact, three terms. Alambana uparaktam, colored by the object. Alambana uparaktam, colored by the object. So the sun, as though colors your mind. And then, rupa samapannam, takes on the form. Now this is perhaps not a great example, but the form of orangeness, I know orangeness isn't exactly a form, but the form of orangeness is taken on by the crystal. In the metaphor, not only that the sun colors your mind, but your mind takes on the form of sun. Now, what does that mean? Your mind takes on the form of sun. Mind is vritti. Mind is thoughts. Please tell me, what is a mind minus thoughts? Mind is thoughts. Mind is vritti. So therefore, suppose in your mind is one repeating vritti, and that vritti is in the form of the sun. In that case, your mind takes on the form of the sun. So here he says, rupa samapannam, and also rupa abhasam. Your rupa abhasam, abhasam appears. Appears in that particular form. So the crystal appears as orange. Your mind appears like the sun. These three terms seem to have a lot of overlap. Alambana uparaktam, rupa samapannam, and rupa abhasam. Vyasa is really like the you know the expression where you hit someone over the head trying to get them to understand something? That's what Vyasa is doing to us right now by using three terms that have almost the same meaning to make sure that we get it. And what it is, when you meditate on an object, he says, alambana uparaktam, banging on our heads, your mind is colored by the object. Rupa samapannam, banging on our head, your mind acquires the form of the object. Rupa abhasam, your mind appears as the object. You meditate on the sun, your mind takes on, is colored by that sun, your mind takes on the form of the sun, your mind appears as the sun. You meditate on Bhagavan, your mind is colored by that form of God. Your mind takes on the form of that form of God. Your mind appears as that form of God. These are three very powerful expressions. This is part of Vyasa's commentary here, used to describe how complete the presence of the object is during meditation in sampragnata samadhi. And the words used here to describe that, tatstha taranjanata. So that's a metaphor. Just like this cloth is present in the crystal and utterly colors it. In the same way, the dhyana visaya, the object of meditation, fills your mind so completely that the only thing present in your mind is the object of meditation. Now, the last part we have to see in this present sutra is what is the object for sampragnata samadhi. Well, a object, one object, an object, many objects, and he actually takes the objects into three categories. So on what objects will you turn your attention to for the sake of some prajnata samadhi? He gives three categories of objects: grahitra, grahana, and grahya. We have to take each one of these sequentially. So graheshu, with reference to these three categories of objects of meditation, dhyana vishaya. Objects of meditation are brought under these three categories. First category, grahya. Grahya literally means that which, the simple meaning of these words, by the way, grahya is that which you grasp. Grahana is the means of grasping. And grahitra is a grasper, the one doing the grasping. Now, of course, we're not talking about grasping in a physical sense, although the word used here can have that sense. We're talking about grasping in an experiential sense. So grasping in an experiential sense, now let's relook at these three words. To grasp experientially, grahya means an object of experience. Like me sitting in front of you, like Bhagavan standing on the altar, like the sun in the sky, an object is grahya, an external object, a physical object. Need not be physical. Any object, grahya, could be subtle as well. Grahana is the means of experience. Means of experience for physical objects is our sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell, our five sense organs. But then a lot of things we experience are not outside. A lot of them are inside. In our last class, we talked about meditating on something you experienced in a dream. One of the things we talked about in our last class. Dreams you experience not with your eyes and ears. Dreams you experience only with your mind. Which is why we talk about pancha jnanendriya, jnana indriya, jnanendriya. Five sense organs plus one. Five sense organs, sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell, plus one antahkarana, the inner sense. Five senses are pointed out into the world. One sense organ, the antahkarana. Antahkarana is one of our words for mind. So the mind is considered a sense organ which is inward looking. So grahana refers to these six. Five sense organs plus the mind. So the first category of objects of meditation are grahya, anything you experience. The second category of objects for meditation are the grahana, the means for experience, which are the five senses plus your own mind. And the third category, and the most interesting one, for the category of objects for meditation is grahitra, the experiencer. So grahya, objects of experience, grahana, the means of experience, senses, and grahitra, the experiencer. These are the three categories. Now, Vyasa and the sub-commentator go into quite some detail on these. We'll just do it a little briefly here. Grahya is fairly self-explanatory. I gave sun as an example before, earth as an example. Other examples, when you're meditating on your breath during pranayama, if you are meditating on a sound, chanting out loud, om, om, even chanting silently, reciting your mantra. Your mantra, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namo Narayanaya, becomes an object. It's in your mind, but it's still an object. If it's a sound object outside, you're chanting out loud, Om Namah Shivaya, or if you're chanting silently, and Om Namah Shivaya is a mantra in your mind, in both cases, they are grahya, they are objects. And in this form, in this meditation that culminates in samapatti, the great accomplishment, samapatti, is samprajnata samadhi, and that takes place when your object of meditation, if it's the sun, if it's earth, if it's an image, if it's a sound, if it's a mantra, whatever it is, when that form, tatstha and taranjanata, when it pervades your mind utterly, when it's the only thing present in your mind and it doesn't change, that is sampragnata samadhi. So first category is grahya. Second category, grahana, when you reflect on your own power of sight, your own power of hearing, or much more fascinating, reflect on your own power of observing. This is done actually during sakshi bhava, during a form of meditation also called vipassana, where you just observe. Observe and observe. Well, let's go through this a little bit. To meditate on a sense, to meditate on sight, for example, would be to meditate on the capacity to see anything at all. Not to meditate on a particular object. To meditate on a particular object you see with your eyes open or with your eyes closed is grahya. But grahana means that your power of sight becomes the subject matter for your meditation. I don't know how to explain that. I've never done that kind of meditation. This again starts to suggest how this meditation as taught by Yoga Sutra is a bit of a lost art. What does it mean? Meditate on your power of sight. I've never done that meditation. I couldn't tell you how it's done. I'm not sure if we all went to Rishikesh and started asking all the sadhus in Rishikesh, asking someone, how is this done? I doubt we would find anyone who could tell us. There might be some people, but they're probably exceedingly rare because these forms of meditation are so rarely practiced today. So if I haven't practiced a meditation, I can't tell you how to do it. I'm not the person to do that. We have to find someone else. So grahana could be meditating on your capacity for sight, hearing, taste, touch, or smell. But the one that I can tell you about is when the grahana is your own mind. To meditate on your own mind is a wonderful meditation. The way it's done is you start with vipassana. You start with sakshi bhava. And it means you start by just being a detached observer. Any thought comes in your mind, you just observe the thought. To the extent that you're no longer thinking the thoughts, you're just observing anything that bumps into your mind. Usually we use our will to stick thoughts in our minds. We choose. We choose in many ways. We turn our eyes in a certain direction. And in that way, we load our minds with a certain image. Or we turn on some music or some TV, and we load our ears with certain sounds. We're using our free will to load our minds. Or you choose to think about something. You choose to remember something. We use our will to load our minds with so much stuff. Normal. Suppose you suspend the use of your will to load your mind. In fact, you use your will to remain as a detached observer. What I'm describing is vipassana or sakshi bhava in a little bit of a technical way because we're studying Yoga Sutra here. So suppose you use your will not to think thoughts, but you use your will just to observe whatever bubbles up in your mind. This is what's called sakshi bhava or vipassana. That's the preparation for this. We're talking about now not observing objects, but a form of sampragnata samadhi. First of all, vipassana can never be samadhi. Why? Change, right? Different thoughts are bubbling up in your mind. They're always changing. We've defined again and again, samadhi is an unchanging condition of your mind. Therefore, any practice of vipassana, by definition, does not culminate in samadhi as defined by Patanjali. But it can prepare us for a form of samadhi. Suppose you go on for quite some time just observing whatever bubbles up in your mind. You may have had this experience. Sometimes when you look for your thoughts, sometimes they go away. Not always. But if your mind is well prepared from all of the prior practices that we've discussed here, if your mind has citta prasada, is as clear as a crystal, if your mind is vashikara, has been brought under complete control through the practice of so much prior meditation, then imagine doing vipassana, watching your thoughts, and then imagine the thought stopping. Now, be careful now. You don't make the thought stop. They stop on their own. They stop on their own. Why do they stop on their own? All of the preparation that you've done. If you've done this much preparation, you can have the experience of watching your thoughts and seeing the flow of thoughts get less and less and less and less and less until you're just observing fewer and fewer thoughts until you're observing no thoughts, which means you're observing the silence of your mind. Now, that's close to this, but it's still not samadhi because you're still observing something. This says to meditate on grahana, on the mind. So suppose you're observing a silent mind and a very subtle shift of direction takes place and you become aware of your mind observing silence. Let me try that again. Too subtle. You're observing silence. Observing silence. Emphasis is on silence. Suppose we shift the, since there's nothing to observe, suppose we shift the emphasis from silence to observing. Instead of observing silence, there's only observing. It's a slight shift of perspective. You're not looking out into the mind, into the silence of the mind, but rather reflecting on your mind's capacity to observe. Reflecting is not the right word because it suggests that you're thinking. You are just present with your mind's capacity to observe. Let me try a metaphor. I know it's very abstract. Of course, the only way to really learn this stuff is what? Go into the lab and try it for yourself. Means what? Meditate. Means to do enough preparation and to do enough vipassana so that you can go on observing your thoughts and watch your thoughts trail off to nothing and then go observing nothing. You can do it. It's not impossible to do these forms of meditation. Here's a metaphor. Suppose you're standing in funny example. This is a simple experiment you can try tonight. Go home, go into your bedroom, open up your closet, go inside, close the door. You're now standing in this pitch black closet. Of course, leave the light off, right? So imagine go and do this. You stand in a pitch black closet and you can look at the darkness. You can look at the absence of objects. That is, your attention is focused out into the darkness. That's like vipassana when the stream of thoughts have trailed off. By the way, that usually doesn't happen, I have to tell you. For most people, when you do vipassana, usually the thoughts keep coming and keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. And they do that because of insufficient preparation. if you have done enough preparation, you can have the experience of doing vipassana and witnessing the train of thoughts waning away. You can. So, to symbolize that, imagine standing in your closet with your attention out on the darkness. So that represents vipassana while you're observing a silent mind. Now imagine standing in a closet and ask yourself the question, am I blind or do I have the power of sight? And allow yourself to experience your power of sight in the pitch black closet. That's the shift I'm talking about. And I know it's very subtle, but that's the subject matter we're talking about. So observing the darkness is like vipassana. But when you shift your attention to having sight in that dark closet, you're now turning your attention to the grahana, to the sense organ. And that's the meditation that's described here. So when the grahana could be the external senses, sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell, and how that really works in meditation, I can't tell you, although the story I've just told could lend itself in that direction, but I don't know. But the real application of this grahana meditation is during vipassana to observe a silent mind and then to be aware of the mind itself as an instrument in that thoughtless condition. So this is sampragnata samadhi based on the grahana. The last category, grahitra. Grahya is object, grahana is the means of knowing, and grahitra is the knower, the experiencer, the grasper. And that becomes the object of meditation. Now, in what way? We've actually talked about this once before. I said Pujya Swamiji's, Swami Dayanandaji's, my guru's explanation. He's often called this meditation on the meditator. And this can be done in two different ways. One is you meditate on the ego. We've talked previously about asmita. Asmita, that sense of I. So one is meditation on ego, that sense of I-ness. Some of you may also have read books by or about Sri Ramana Maharshi, who talked about being aware of that constant flow of I. When your mind is silent, you can get the sense that I am. My thoughts are gone. The world, it's interesting, in meditation, first the world is gone, then your body is gone, then your five senses are gone, emotions are gone, thoughts are gone, but I'm not gone yet. I am still there. That I is ego. And to meditate on that sense of I-ness, being present, and to be absorbed, to have that tatstha and tadanjanata, to have that sense of I-ness as the only event filling your mind. This is sampragnata samadhi, on the grihitra, on the experiencer, on the meditator. So one kind of meditation on the meditator is to meditate on the ego. There's one more kind, and Vyasa gives all these details. I'm sparing you all the, it goes on and on and on in the commentary. So I'm just trying to summarize it for you because it's so important. It's important when you reach that level anyway. The last one he gives, meditation on the grihitra, is meditation on purusha. Now purusha in our context means consciousness, right? Just to be present with consciousness. Consciousness fills your mind. Only consciousness fills your mind. This is a precursor to asampragnata samadhi. Because now even the ego is gone. So the highest extent of these meditations, the lowest is where the grahya is, the lowest category, grahya. And lowest of those are physical things. Then you come up with a step to subtle things, objects in your mind. Then you come up a step to grahana, to the powers of knowing, including your mind itself. And then you come up one more step to the meditator, first as ego, and then finally you arrive at the highest extent, consciousness. The consciousness which is your essential nature. And when that consciousness is tat-ta and tadanjanata, when that consciousness fills your mind, and nothing else fills your mind, this condition is here called samapattihi, the accomplishment in meditation, or as we've said before, sampragnata samadhi. This, I think of all the sutras we've studied thus far in this first pada, there is more teaching in this one sutra. And the treatment we've given it here is perhaps far too brief for what this sutra really deserves. I hope, and I know some of my explanations are not, I wish my explanations could be more vivid, but this is tough. Sometimes I feel like that person trying to describe what a peach tastes like. And you know, you can go on trying and trying and trying to describe what a particular fruit tastes like, but all of the words in the world don't replace the experience. So what I've attempted to do is to give you an idea of what various kinds of samadhi, going through a succession of steps, going from most gross to most subtle, I've tried to give you some sense of what these kinds of samadhi might be like. But really speaking, all that I've told you is meaningless, and I'll admit it. What I've told you is really meaningless. Meaningless as a subject matter. Meaningful if it inspires you to meditate, that's where the meaning comes. The purpose is in inspiring you to meditate and maybe giving you some pointers and a direction to go in your meditation. But as a subject matter, what I've just said is meaningless, just like when you try to describe the taste of a fruit. The only way to get the taste of the fruit is to taste that fruit for yourself. In the same way, the only way really to know this samapatti, this accomplishment meditation, with reference to grahya, various objects, with reference to grahana, with reference to your mind, and finally with reference to grahitra, with reference to yourself, the only way to really get it is to meditate. Go there and do that. Okay. So this sutra also introduces another sequence of sutras talking about various kinds of sampragnata samadhi. So what we've started to discuss here with this sutra, we'll carry forward in our next class.